Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Welcome, people of the internet, to another episode of the Fell Into Food Podcast. I am your host, Chef Jeff Fell. With me today is Stephanie Lind, a veteran of the food and beverage industry with more than two decades of experience leading sales, strategy, and innovation for some of the biggest names in the business, including PepsiCo, Cisco, Kerry Group, and Impossible Foods. She's now the founder and CEO of Elohe Strategic Advisors, where she helps emerging and established food and beverage brands scale, navigate the market, and bring truly meaningful products to life. She's built her career at the intersection of taste, strategy, and purpose, working with companies that are all pushing the industry towards better sustainability, better innovation, and better business. So Stephanie, welcome onto the show.
It's nice to be here.
Yeah, I was really excited for this conversation after our initial, you know, powwow that we had had. And the bluntness that you bring to the table is fantastic. So let's just start. What was the aha moment? What was your fell into food that got you into this industry?
I was five. I was a Girl Scout. I had to sell cookies and I loved it and I was good at it. But that was back in the days where like you had to dial the phone and your mom didn't put it on her Facebook or take it to the office. And my mom refused to take it to her office. She was in real estate, so she could have. I had to call every single person and sell them and then do the math of what they owed me. But every year she'd get to the point where she's like, no more. You can't sell anymore. Because she would have to drive me around to deliver it and have the cash to make change. So if it wasn't like fairly local, I could put it in my, swear to God, my little Red Flyer wagon and take it down the street to deliver. Then she had to schlep me around. So I think that's when I learned how much I loved to sell. Probably it was a wake-up call for my mom that I was a little competitive because there was one girl every year I really wanted to beat.
I feel that's how it is in all Girl Scouts. Every time I've got some family members, extended family members are on my wife's side, and they're always talking about who can sell the most cookies, and you're getting bombarded by different ones.
Okay, but there's the girls who actually do the selling, and then there's the girls, especially now, that go set up in front of a jewel at...
That's true.
Sorry, that's cheating.
That's guilt tripping. I hate when they do that. I feel bad. Like I want some Girl Scout cookies and you have these cute little girls and they're like, buy our cookies.
I'll buy one. Like, I'll buy a thin mint. And then I tell them, find me on LinkedIn. Here's my name. You sell to me, little girl.
Okay, so 5 years old, you're selling cookies.
Yeah.
Then, you know, obviously, you know, you go into teenage years. Like, when was it that you said, okay, I'm actually going to make something out of this. I enjoy selling. And particularly in the food business, right? You could have sold, there's 1,000 routes, car salesman, insurance, 100 things to do.
You had to go to car salesman first, really? Is that a message for me?
No, absolutely not.
In all seriousness, when I graduated from college, between my freshman and sophomore year, I did an archaeological dig in Idaho, and I really wanted to be in anthropology. And my mom said over her dead body, "That's not a real job." She wasn't wrong, but I loved it. So then, between junior and senior year, I worked on the Hill, so in for a congressman, but on the House Select Committee on Hunger, which was for me. And a real eye-opener about how we think about feeding the poor and the elderly and so forth. I mean, and I had to do this big report on our food system. And ironically, I'd worked as a cashier in high school. So taking WIC forms, and that was what literally you had to stop and like write everything down. And we barely had scanners at that point. But I really planned on going back to DC and doing something along those lines, working for a big nonprofit and less about food, although it was about food. It was about how you feed people and take care of people. But 1992 came along and I was graduating and we were in the first Iraq war. We were in a huge recession. Nobody was getting jobs. And I actually got a job at Frito-Lay. So my first job out of college was on a truck at Frito-Lay. And ironically, it was called a sales job, but really it was like I drove around a little mobile warehouse that I had to stock every day and sell from. And I loved the supply chain plus sales piece of it. So there's kind of this thread that goes throughout my career. But I don't think I really realized how good I was at selling until I went to Nabisco, which was my next job in food. And I had the customer that nobody wanted to deal with. No one. And I got it. And I was a little account rep and I was like 23, 24. And I put together a program that everybody told me it would never work. I couldn't make I wouldn't be able to make the financials work. Basically, I created my own EDLP program, kind of like what the big guys were doing for Walmart. But it was a combination of having to do the strategic thinking of like, this is one of our biggest customers in the area. And the guy I'm calling on is
you could say it. It's okay.
He's an asshole. He would literally line, Wednesday was the only day you could see him, and he would line you up in the aisle of the store, all the vendors, and didn't get an appointment. He would call you and be like, hey, Nabisco. So I got called right after one of the beer guys in Frito-Lay after he read them the riot act because he had a little office that was glass. So literally the customers could hear it too. I mean, it was just nuts. It was like 7 a.m. And after leaving that store sobbing, the first one, I was like, I'm competitive. I think a little bit of it, don't tell me I can't because I'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But I spent months putting together a program and negotiating with him and gaining his respect, but also not backing down. Again, I was like 24 and I got it sold and it worked and the sales went up and our trade spend actually went down. And it was, for me, it was a little bit of like, haha, I told you I could get it done to the people internally who were the ones who made me take the account because they didn't want it. But also just to myself of the, you know, again, if you're sit down and you're thoughtful about what the customer needs and what they're trying to accomplish. And then when you're working for a manufacturer, you like it or not, you have guardrails, right? There's a system you're working within that doesn't always make sense. Not every company is customer friendly. And I'm at the point now where if they're not customer friendly, I'm not interested in as a client today or back then.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not for me because it is a two-way street. But I love puzzles and I love logic problems and really sales. If you do it right, it is a puzzle. It is a logic.
Yeah, it truly is. And I want to go back because you said you're fine. Therapy. 23 at 23. To have the courage to want to say, I'm going to do this. Cause I remember when I was 23, I got into the industry late. I was like 24 when I went back to culinary school and started my food career. So I was nervous as shit going into a kitchen.
Yeah.
What gave you that courage? Do you think it was because you'd done some sales earlier in your life or was it a product of your environment?
So that's a good question. It's pretty interesting. So when I was in high school, my mom, she started in real estate and then she moved over into selling ads for the local CBS station. And she was really good, really, really good, like one of the top in the nation. But I was 16. And while I wasn't a bad kid, I think she was just trying to, you know, keep me on the straight and narrow. So when she had this territory that was southeastern Missouri, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Southern Illinois. So it was the worst and most difficult territory in the country because you're talking about four or five different markets.
Mm-hmm.
It was really complicated. It was a puzzle. And she would literally take me with her on 2 to 3 day road trips. So I'd be sitting in the car with her, helping her prepare for her meetings. You know, I'd be in the hotel room with her when she's practicing her presentation. And I can remember sitting in the car with her one day at 16 and she said, selling's really difficult. People underestimate how smart you have to be good at it, which I think was her way of saying, like, she knew I had that natural ability. And she said, you're going to have to get 9 no's to get to the yes. And if you give up on the 8th no, shame on you, because you've only got one more to go.
Mm.
And I don't know why, but that always stuck with me. And if you knew my mother, she was a force of nature, apple tree. And again, for her, she was very competitive. She was very mathematically, like, she was much more mathematical than I am. But, you know, she loved a puzzle. And, you know, again, a little bit of it's nurture and nature. It was also the, you know, at 24, I kept getting promoted really fast. And I, and again, this was in 1992, 93, 94, where a lot of the men around me were not happy at how fast I was getting promoted. And I had men literally, the guy who trained me at Frito-Lay, the first day on the truck with him said, you're going to get my job. You're going to get my promotion. Right.
Wow.
The same thing at Nabisco. Like, you're going to take somebody's job that's been doing this for 20 years. And I remember just thinking, why can't it just be that I'm good at it, but also competitive? You know, I'm going to succeed, and I'm going to do it on hard work. And I did. And I gained their, like, I gained their respect. But sales is a hard, it's a hard job if you do it right and you do it with integrity. But it's really rewarding. I like
it. Yeah, I was going to say, with the integrity part, most people will push sales, but it's not in a way that, like you said, just sheer integrity. It's, I just need to make a sale. I'm going to do whatever it takes, whatever snake oil I have to do, whatever.
And companies white lies behavior, right? So again, I also think you get from people what you incent them to do.
Yeah, and even if it's the honest truth, I think a lot of people respect the fact that you can be honest with them. I know in my days, purchasing world of dealing with vendors and manufacturers, and simply telling them no, thank you, now is not the time, or I don't think your product's ready. I but then later in life or later down the road, it was a fit sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I think we kept that relationship, and it was a mutually respectful, and we had that integrity towards each other that we knew it was business. It was no hard feelings. It was like, this is business. This is what I have to do. And they understood, and they were under that mindset of like, this is just another one of those no's.
Right.
You're going to be my number 10 yes, even if it is down the road.
Well, and that happens, the bigger, the more complex, like the enterprise deals. Like at PepsiCo, when I moved into food service, because I was retail for the first 15 years, I was on the team whose job it was to basically go out and create noise for Coke on the deals we knew we were never going to get, and hopefully cost them as much money as possible, because then they couldn't come after the ones that we really wanted, or that we had. And I remember there was a deal I worked on, and I really connected with the gal who was doing the deal for this chain, because she was very high integrity, no bullshit as well. And she said to me, when she called to give me the news, she said, I want to give you this deal. I should give you this deal. But the other guy has come in with so much money, I can't say no. And it was literally like, and that was crushing for me, because I deserved, like, I worked really hard on that deal. In retrospect, like, that was a badge of honor. Like, I should have gotten the deal, and it wouldn't have mattered. I couldn't have done any more work to get it or not get it. I think the best thing I ever did was take that job in Fountain on biz dev at PepsiCo, because I didn't just have Pepsi. I had Tropicana, Gatorade, Frito-Lay, and Quaker. And so then I had to learn five lines of business and four different P&Ls and five different marketing departments. And some used brokers and some did distributors, and Frito-Lay was direct, and PepsiCo had Pepsi had bottlers. And that's where, like, if I just stayed with that job or that kind of a selling job, I could have made so much money. But, and I enjoyed it. But working for big companies just wasn't, and I didn't know it yet, it just wasn't a good fit for me.
And at what age was that when you were still at PepsiCo?
So I was there from the time I was, I was there from Frito-Lay 22 to like 23 and a half. And then I went back through the beverage division, through the Lipton partnership, which was a JV with Unilever, which was really interesting. When I was 29, and I stayed until I was 30, almost 39, and I got laid off.
Okay. Okay, so you had the run of mill. I mean, you'd been around and you understood in depth, not just a quick pit stop. It was, I understand. And to your point, PepsiCo is massive with all the different divisions. And I dealt with it.
I loved working there. Like, to be honest, they were an amazing employer. But it was 2008 and I was in food service selling new business. And it was the beginning. Like, we were the 3,000 people I was laid off with were like, we were one of the first companies that had a really big layoff. And in retrospect, man, did they take care of us. Holy moly. And it worked out because my mom had cancer and was going to need a mastectomy, which I found out at about the same time. So I got paid to basically go take care of my mom. So no complaints. But I also had a weird run of jobs at PepsiCo too. I did not have a typical job ever at PepsiCo. I came in through the Lipton partnership, which was JV. So when I was hired, I literally got to choose, do you want to work for Unilever or PepsiCo? Because the JV said it had to be 50-50 and they were 50-50. So I got to choose. And then I went and did this non-carb team where all the things they were buying and you had the Lipton partnership and you had the Starbucks partnership and all these things that weren't brown bubbly water that go into PET and are hot fill, which I loved. So I spent almost a year in Bentonville kind of teaching that national account team how to sell all the things that weren't Pepsi. And then I went and spent 3 years building out Sobe right after we acquired it.
I remember good old Sobe, the good old gecko.
I loved working there because, again, you had the benefit of working in a really innovative environment. Again, I'm a slow learner, but I did, once I kind of looked back at how things went, it was a very innovative, break the rules. Like, again, I was in my early 30s and coming over from PepsiCo, everybody's in there, you know, you wore a suit to NRA, you wore a suit to Max, right? To Sobe, where you were just glad if they got out of their PJs, they were in flip-flops, they had brought their dogs to work before it was a cool thing. I remember we did the Howard Stern show and nobody told Pepsi legal because they'd say no. And I had, at the time, I had a lot of reservations personally about Howard Stern, but I have never laughed so hard in my life. And it was a fit for the brand. So that was a kind of a wake up call that you don't have to look like the product you're selling, but you got to believe in it. And I did believe in Sobe, the brand, like that it was aspirational and I could sell the heck out of it, but I was not the, like what you would put up as the target market, but neither were any of my buyers.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting across from some old fat white guy who smokes and drinks and like, just hoping he can retire before he has a heart attack and talking to him about guarana and ginseng and, you know, all these things that, and I'd look at him and say like, me neither, dude, but that's what the customer wants.
Yeah. It's about the customer. And you mentioned something about believing in the product to sell it. Mm-hmm. I think that is one of the most underrated things because it doesn't feel like selling per se. If you truly believe in a product, if you truly believe it has a benefit for whatever reason, for whatever demographic that you're targeting, it doesn't feel like selling. You're just telling them about something because you're trying to improve their operation, right, people's lives. And that's what I've also found with that integrity and in sales, that the ones that I listened to most, you could tell they were really passionate about the product in one way, shape or form. For some reason, it could have been a story about a family member, it touched them and they tried a product. But those seem to be the ones that truly I was more engaged with and listened with. Mm-hmm. And even though we may have not made deals, I was like, I'm going to keep that person on speed dial because if something comes up, I feel a connection to that person versus the typical salesperson.
So that is what you just said. Like, I really connected with that brand or the person or the story, but we didn't necessarily make a deal. That is exactly the problem in food service with emerging brands. Because they don't, instead of targeting who they should target, in a lot of cases, they're just targeting whoever the last person said they should target, or whoever they can get on the phone, and they spend a lot of time talking to people who are never going to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And I struggle with it because what I know is they're losing money and they're losing time chasing targets. I'm not saying that that wasn't you in this case, but I see this with brands that come in all the time and they're like, well, I just want chain accounts, or I want you to get me into Dot or fill in the blank. And I'm like, that's great, but that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Let's go into Alohi in a second. I want to touch on Alohi, sorry,
he.
My apologies.
Alohi.
Yeah. Not I, he.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Or he.
So you made a stop at Impossible.
Yes, but
before Alohi.
No.
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 Okay, so this was after.
Yeah, so I founded Alohi in 2015 after throwing a temper tantrum and saying, I'm not working for any more assholes. I'll be the only asshole I ever work for again, even if I have to eat government cheese. And about 2.5 years in, they reached out to me based on a reference from someone else and told me what they were trying to do. And I was like, you guys are doing it wrong. I spent like 3 months saying, you guys are doing it wrong. Like your pricing is whack. You're like the way you're dividing up the industry is whack. Your forecasts were like, it was just, and it's that typical like kind of tech way of looking at food that it just does, like the math doesn't work. And they brought in consultants and employees who frankly didn't understand food service. So I spent about 3 months saying, you're doing it wrong. I can't help you if that's the way you're going to do it. And then another kind of 6 months saying, all right, well, you can pay me a lot of money for me to tell you you're doing it wrong if that makes you happy. And then all of a sudden they had a plant up and they're like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And I was like, well, you could do what I've been telling you to do for 9 months. And they're like, okay, we'll write that plan. So I did. It was what I've been telling them for the last 9 months. And then I went in actually as an employee of Impossible Foods as the head of global sales for the launch in 2018 that I'd been putting together for the kind of year previous. And then, but I still owned Alohi. So the board had to ratify me using Alohi. I put together a program where I used some brokers, some independent contractors, some of my people, some of the people that we had hired at Impossible, and spent the next, you know, kind of 12 months basically doing that launch and leading the team and building out the team. And then I woke up and went, oh God, I don't like working for other people. Like, so, and the one thing I do know at this point, companies don't listen to you as an employee the way they will listen to somebody from the outside. They just don't.
It's yeah. Why do you think that is? I will agree with you on that. That there's something about you would think that like someone with the experience that knows what they're doing from the inside, that they would have at least more of a 60-40 than less. But no. But someone else from the outside comes in and they're just like, Oh, this is amazing. Even though it may be, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, at least in my experience, that it was the same thing I was saying. And you're like, I've been saying this. Why did you listen to what I said 6 months ago? But now you've paid some consultant umpteen bazillion dollars and you want to listen to them.
Okay. So I'll tell you the flip side of that. I had somebody that got hired at a brand that I love and I actually have in my freezer. And when she got hired, she said, I want to bring you in so you can help me with some things. And the company fired her because they said, well, why do we need you if you're just going to bring in a consultant? And it's because one person can't do all the things ever in a launch, ever. And they can't ever do it fast enough either. In that case, you had management who, frankly, thought they were always going to be the smartest guy in the room, even though they were churning through heads of sales. The flip side, which is what you're asking about, is I'm not sure what it is. I mean, as I will tell you, the difference for me is as an employee, I'm trying to show some respect. You feel like you have more safety as an employee, which really you don't. All any employee has is a 2-week contract. And so I think that in a lot of ways, and because we've all been convinced that if you don't have an employer, you can't have healthcare. Like all these things that frankly you don't, because you've never had to do it, right? I'd always worked for other people, but my mom built her own business. So I was able to kind of see the flip side. But it's a lot of employees are risk averse, right? I changed my behavior as an employee at Impossible because that was the expectation of employees. Whether you like it or not, you mold to some extent, or you get to the point where you don't mold like me and you or they go, well, this isn't working.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
It's the competing priorities. So the other piece is, in a lot of cases, the human inclination to listen to people you trust. I find that in a lot of cases, CEOs don't necessarily trust the right people. And they have a bit of a disdain for salespeople. So that gets wound into it a bit because most of them have never actually had to sell anything. And if you look at boards, it's the same thing. There are no salespeople on the board. They love having marketing people. Great. Put out another campaign. Who's going to close the deal? Oh, that's
right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure exactly what it is. But I'm not afraid to just flat out tell people you're doing it wrong and I can't help you. Like, I can fire a client. Yes, I could have fired my employer, but again, I just think it's we've been trained to think that that's not the case. And especially
Yeah.
as you get older, because when I was younger, like, and this was before, like, we were really using the internet, recruiters knew who I was at 24, 25, 26. So I thought I would get phone calls on my home phone because we didn't have cell phones. But as you get older too, and I think you have other responsibilities, I think you also become more risk averse, which leads you to maybe not speak up the way that you should. And at the end of the day, I've been fired twice. And in both cases, I knew within 2 months, like, this is not a good fit for me. They said they wanted is not what they will actually tolerate. But in both cases, I was in a high profile job and I had been relocated. And if you relocate and you leave, you have to repay that. And that could be a $100,000 ticket. So you have to wait for them to fire you. Like, or you have to find another job and that employer has to buy out your contract. So it's, you get incented, especially as you go up the ladder as well, which more most consultants are coming in to help at a more senior level. You're not incented to be a truth teller at all. Because the politics at that level are stupid.
They're just as bad as real politics. The politics in food are just as bad in any, doesn't matter what
There's
branch
a different
of the food industry.
We can talk about that ad nauseum, but yes.
Oh, for sure. Just what you're saying is resonating so much with what I've gone through as well. And the same thing. And I'm going to put a pin in it, and I think I'm going to put it somewhere, is that as an employee, you're always on a 2 week contract.
You are.
Because it's the truth. In a moment, they could pull the trigger and you're gone and everything is turned upside down.
That's right.
It's what happened to me. But there
they
is such a
give you severance, right? And you might get unemployment, but dear God.
Right. And it is a scary unknown going on your own, trying to figure it out, the ups and downs of where's the next meal going to come from? Where's the next paycheck going to come from? You're clawing, you're scraping, you're trying to figure it out. But there's something liberating about the fact that no one's thumb is on you. Yes, you may have clients that you're working with, but usually there's some sort of mutual agreement between you and your clients of what the work scope is going to be, timelines, time frames. You know, that's what I've set up as well. And it's so much more liberating when it's like, hey, can you do this and this on this date? No, I don't have to tell you yes.
You can't make me.
And you can't make me. I mean, you could technically fire me as from your client. But what is it really worth it at the end of the day if I'm providing value to you and your company? But yeah, that freedom to do what you need to do when you need to do it. And again, as me having a family, it's been so much easier when the kids, things happen and I need to take care of them, or it's, hey, the afternoon I need to be off. There isn't someone saying, too bad, you don't have sick time.
Everybody's returning to office or else, even though we let you move 4 hours away, now you got to move back or do a 4 hour commute one way.
Yes. Yes. Insane. Okay, so real quick, back to impossible, because of the plant sector, I've talked to people in and out of that, and it's a fascinating sector, and especially where it's at today and how it's kind of, you know, it went on this, correct me if I'm wrong, because you were in it. It went on this huge boom, right? This huge spike. People, I don't think, knew what they didn't know what they didn't know.
Oh my God.
And they're like, this is a great thing, especially when Impossible got its deal with Burger King that just exploded the brand. And so you had this huge explosion in plant-based. And then it was, what, 2020, 2021, around that? It felt like there was this dip in which people were like, wait, this really isn't the healthy alternative, the clean alternative. And I feel like there was this cleanup phase at some point where brands had to start changing their formulas because people were realizing that the amount of ingredients and again, not just Impossible, but all plant-based sector, it felt like it was very chemically, scientifically engineered. Like you said, it's scientists that came in and said, hey, we can create a food product, but don't really know anything about food or have worked in food. They're just like, hey, it's kind of like robotics in food is a lot of these robotic machines. They're all these engineers, but they've never worked in food. They're like, I can create a machine that can make a hamburger for you. And it's like, okay, great. But have you ever worked in food? And they're like, no. Well, then how do you know what kind of hamburger machine you should be making?
Yeah.
They just do it. And then they belly up because they don't know how it applies to the real world.
Yeah. It's it literally just, like, I don't know if the audience could hear my eyes roll back in my head. They did a 360. So what happened was you had kind of the rise of plant-based in about 2016.
And the reason for that is Bill Gates started getting involved, and you started having the Google and Yahoo. You had all these people making money and cashing out and starting to need to invest. And a lot of the big tech guys were, they weren't necessarily vegan, but they were looking for a place to put their money. And so brands like Hampton Creek were getting funded. And then brands like Beyond and Impossible were getting funded. And those are the ones that everybody saw because they, again, they had the Bill Gates money. They had the big, you know, overseas sovereign funds putting money in. And not just like $1 million, $100 million, $200 million. It was just, it was too much money. And so in 2016, 2017, people were starting to become more aware of a plant-based diet. There was a lot of movement. And again, I'm not vegan and I will never be vegan for a lot of reasons, although I've become much closer to that. And there was this war amongst the, what people didn't see underneath was fascinating. There was this war between PETA and then kind of some of the plant-based companies. And then you had the meat companies. Like I had to be trained. Like I went through an extensive PR training. Because they would ambush us at trade shows, like you never knew where, and we were getting invited to speak all the time, but then you never knew who was going to send somebody. And it could be PETA or it could be the meat lobby. I mean, it was nuts. So a lot of what undid plant-based, frankly, were all the mission-based investors who put a lot of money in to founders that should never have gotten money in the first place or should have gotten it. In a certain way. And then they hired a lot of people to sell the product and market the product who were going to, like, I remember taking people from Impossible into Cisco to meet with Buckhead Beef. And I was like, guys, they don't give a shit that you're a vegan. And by the way, they don't like that you're a vegan. Mm-hmm. I already knew they'd cut the deal with Beyond Meat. But for me, it was more of a, this is what you're up against. And this is why you're not going to be successful if you don't change how you're doing things. So there was that. And then 2020 hit. So because everybody was going after restaurants, because Beyond Meat and Impossible had been successful in restaurants, that was everybody's go-to-market strategy. Well, restaurants closed and plant-based meat did not hold up for delivery. So you had a lot of guys that sort of went under, but you also had a lot of guys that got a lot more funding in 2020, but you just didn't see the activity. 2021 and 22, things didn't rebound as fast as everybody would have liked in restaurants, because again, we kept having different strains and lockdowns. But what really nailed the coffin was 2023 was Silicon Valley Bank. And that happened at Expo West, because I remember I was supposed to have a big meeting and that client brought it up like 2 years later. You were supposed to meet with us. I'm like, yeah, I had a client who literally had every penny in Silicon Valley Bank and weren't going to make payroll. And that included our check. So I had a priority and it was not you.
Right, right.
But that crashed the system for the products getting funded.
That makes a lot of sense.
It was an excuse for those investors not to put money in. And that forced the reckoning as well. You also had a lot of big companies like Tyson had that Tyson Ventures. Tyson Ventures had money in Beyond Meat and New Way Foods. That was one of our clients. They had money in a lot in one of the cultured meats, cell cultured meats. But what really undid that space was nothing to do with whether or not it's healthy. That's some bullshit. It was the infighting underneath. It was who was getting funded and why. It was watching some brands get funded and funded and funded that shouldn't have been funded after the first time they got funded. And then other companies who had amazing products who couldn't get off the ground because they couldn't get funded because they weren't part of the cool kids. They didn't have a tech background. They weren't in San Francisco, whatever the reason was. So I'm going to write a book someday. I'm not sure if I'm quite far enough away from Impossible for them not to get their panties in a twist. And it's not just about Impossible. I mean, I've talked to just about every cell cultured and plant-based company out there. And to me, it wasn't the brands, it was some of the founders, but it was more the investor set and the mission-based investors and how they thought about investing and where they put their money and then how they managed those companies. I watched a couple go out of business because of how and there was in particular one group of VC, would basically force them to do certain things or not do certain things and hire certain consultants or not. And it's egregious. But you know what? That's venture capital. I mean, again, VC gets a bad name. There's some great VC out there. There are some really good ones. But anybody coming into food that doesn't understand food and they're investing needs to be at the board meeting to learn and listen and provide value on things that don't have to do with selling and marketing food, because it's not the same.
Yeah. And that transitions a little bit right into Alohi and what you're doing now, right?
Ooh, yeah.
You realized, okay, corporate wasn't probably your route. You realized that, I'm assuming after the PepsiCo layoff, or you had time to think about it.
I did 4 years in food service distribution.
So you're still after that. So
again, you're just like, oh my God, I have to pay my mortgage. How am I going to pay my mortgage? It doesn't occur to you that you could. Like, I didn't know what a consultant really was.
So then what made you say, okay, I'm gonna go out and create a consultancy? Did you already have a plan in mind? Or is it like most of us where we think we know what we're going to do and we're just trying to build it as we go?
Mm-mm. True story. I went to an interview in Tulsa, Oklahoma to be SVP of sales and marketing for a really cool company in electronics, where I was going to get to stand up e-com and do all, they wanted somebody who understood distribution, and I'd done some e-com at my last job. And I walked in and it was me and 60 plus year old men in suits with a Bible on every end table. And I was raised Christian, so it's not about that. It's just, I looked around, I went, oh my God, I'm going to have to take a job and move to someplace I don't want to move and where I don't know anybody, which means if this doesn't work, I have to move again to try to fit into a place that I'm not going to fit in. And I was going to be 44. I was just turning 44, I think. 45. Yeah, just turning 45. And I was like, yeah, I can't do this anymore. It literally almost killed me at my last job. I thought I was having a heart attack at my desk. It turns out it was stress, so it was close. But I literally called my now ex-husband and said, I can't do this anymore. I can't take this job because it's a big paycheck and it's a nice title and all the things. I can't do it. And I said, I am starting my own business. I have no clue what I'm going to do, but I know a lot of people. I know a lot about food service and retail and now industrial and distribution. You know, maybe I'll just be a salesperson for hire, but I can't do this anymore.
Mom.
So it was less about I had a dream and a plan. It was more like I literally just said, I cannot do this anymore. I cashed out my PepsiCo pension and said, when this runs out, if I haven't been able to figure it out, then I'll go get a JOB. But please, God, don't make me have to get a JOB. And I literally was down to $300 in the bank, like $300 left to my name. And I got my first check.
Wow.
And that guy wound up being cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. But it was a great learning. And it was kind of put me on my way.
Wow. So how, like, what were the first few years? Like, how long was it going through that journey till you kind of got down to that breaking bubble and then it kind of then turned around?
2015 was a year of just scraping by and figuring out and networking and going to, like, I went to Expo West for the first time. I went to some trade shows, just trying to craft what my message was going to be. I did recruiting for like 3 months on commission, which I could have been really good at, but again, I couldn't wait for those checks to come in. So I got that check. And then in 2016, I started getting enough clients in that I was like, oh, I need to bring people in. So then I brought in some contractors, but I had a few where, you know, they were between jobs and I get them some work and they'd be like, oh, hey, look, I got another job. I got to go. And I was like, oh, well, that's a problem. So by late in 2016 is when I got my first really big proper customer. In the meantime, in 2016, I had a supply chain project for a really big coffee company where I was helping them through their a distribution RFP. They were getting like 12 deliveries a week in all these little coffee stores. It was nuts.
Wow.
And had a couple hundred thousand square feet warehouse just full of stuff. Like it was just, and a friend of mine had gone in to lead a global supply chain. So that paid the bills while I built the other stuff. But late 2016 is when I got my first proper client. And then a little bit, a couple of months later is when Impossible showed up. But in the meantime, I was getting more sophisticated clients, or at least clients who could pay, a retainer. But at that time, then I was also realizing that we could go sell. We're really good at getting people in, but they weren't ready, right? Or they weren't as ready as I said they were. So that's also when I started a boot camp. And I said, you're going to pay me for 3 months, $5,000 a month for 3 months, and I'm going to put you through a 12-week boot camp, and I'm not selling shit for you until you make it to the other side.
Wow.
You can do it in 6 weeks if you can do it in 6 weeks, but most people couldn't do it in 16 weeks. And for me, what that was it gave me a breather that I wasn't trying to go sell something where I then find out, and this is a true story, oh my God. I sold a Sodexo program for a client who had amazing desserts and literally came back with a like negotiated ready to go. She's like, yeah, I don't want to make that product. I want to sell them this thing instead. I was like, oh my God, that is not how this works.
No.
And another client, I got into Dot Foods, and then they asked her for her first order and she didn't ask us to help her craft that. They called and were like, this is her first order and she wants to send us a full truckload. And I was like, oh, I guess I better go back and educate her on that is not how this works.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until, and a little bit when I look back over it, kind of every year I have that one really big client. And then I have some smaller like consulting gigs and things that funnel through. But I'm not doing business that way anymore because the channel, the industry has changed so much. And frankly, I'm tired of taking on clients who want to be in food service, they want to grow in food service, but they don't have the patience to do the work for it to actually be a profitable venture.
Yeah,
they
most of them
just go sell. And I'm like, good, hire somebody and good luck with that.
Yeah, I've seen that with what I'm doing. Some of the consultancy now is these brands, they think that they're going to come in, they're mostly outside US coming into US, mm-hmm. and they think they know distribution. And it's like,
it's not
Europe is not, yeah. Europe is not the USA.
No.
It is completely different.
Yep.
And they think after that first month or two, they're like, where were all the sales?
Yeah.
We have to build relationships. We have to get things out. We
you're
have
not
to
getting
build
a distributor PO for at least the first 6 months, period. End of story. And that's if you are buttoned up and what you have is on fire and there's no incumbent in your way.
Yeah. So I want to ask there's a couple things that hit me. First was you talked about like in the beginning and networking and how things have changed. So maybe in the beginning, how was it getting clients? Was it just the reputation you had at the places you'd been at with connecting with clients? Was it just going out and doing the networking, going to the Expo Wests and talking to people to get those clients? How did that process work? And then fast forward as times have been changing, what does that look like now? I guess probably because you have a reputation, I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong, that more are coming to you than you're going out constantly prospecting.
So yes and no to the last part, but let's talk about when I started, okay. It was, again, I didn't know for that first year really what I was going to be doing, but going to Expo West was an eye opener. So going from booth to booth to booth and just chatting about food service and like, are you in it? What are you going to do with it? But my first client actually had me come in and be director of sales for retail. Like he wanted to do food service, but I was like, you're in retail. You should probably fix that first. So it was kind of writing that strategy and saying, then this is how food service rides along. A lot of it was just working my network. I was on LinkedIn before anybody knew what LinkedIn was. Like I've been using LinkedIn for years. Now it's a shit show and it makes me sad. But I knew how to work LinkedIn. I also, because I'd spent 3 years at Cisco, I was able to sort of, get on the phone with some people at Cisco early on and just say, what are you guys doing for innovation? How are you working with smaller brands? Getting a feel for that. And I was just kind of connecting people, which is just what I do naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So all of my first clients all came as referrals, predominantly actually from other consultants. the consultants I didn't know until I sort of started getting out into the network. And then when I got, about 2017 was when, 2016, I think, is when I went to Dot Foods. Early in 2016, I went to Dot Foods and I met Rod Willis for the first time. And I didn't know then what I know now, which is that he was really just starting to build out the natural portfolio. So we were both sort of on the same path at the same time. And because I could sit down and talk to him about distribution, which is what they do, and right, how to get emerging brands ready for and into and through distribution, we really hit it off. Now, they didn't favor me over anyone else, but I was like, if you need somebody that's going to be, you know, more sophisticated, they want to be strategic, right? They've got the money and the patience to do it the right way, then by all means, like, call me. If they just want a broker, I'm not interested. Because I thought then, and I still think that that model is just broken. Today, it's funny because I've really gotten my business on referrals for the most part. Walking a trade show occasionally, because then I can connect with people. I can see it. I can taste it. You know, I can listen to how they talk to people on the floor. But for the most part, it's been inbound, and it's been, I have had a lot of clients who come back when they go to a different company. But today I have completely changed my model, where I'm going back to working with more emerging brands. So I have this kind of bifurcation happening, and it's a little bit on purpose, where I have companies with sane executives who want to figure out how to build a food service business. And so they want to be strategic.
Mm-hmm.
I will literally sit down and write a strategy for them on how to get into the channel. So those are more kind of big consulting advisory projects, where it comes down to, like, here's the budget, here's how many people you need and in what roles at what time, and I can help them find those people. And then I have more of the kind of day-to-day emerging brands who are, for the most part, they're sort of in the channel, but they're not quite sure what to do next. And in a lot of cases, they've had another consultant, or maybe they had their own person, or they had a broker, but they weren't getting anywhere with it. And I'm unraveling things a bit. But again, rather than getting in and doing it for them, we've taken kind of our bigger consulting projects and made more DIY. I'll teach you how to do it, which, by the way, is kind of how I started. I'll teach you how to fish, and I'll fish for you or with you while you learn. Whereas now it's more of a, like, I'm going to give you the very, very basics. So your pricing has to be right, and you've got to understand how trade spend flows. You've got to have your messaging pillars, right? You can't just come in and say, my mom thinks these are the best cookies ever. You're talking to an operator. What problem are you solving for them? And, you know, and it's the push-pull of distribution. And then the other piece is they got to get their GDSN right. So people underestimate how important GDSN is, because distributors use that in a lot of cases to do their price book.
And maybe explain what GDSN is for people that don't understand all the acronyms we have in the food world.
So if you've got barcodes, which you should, they're GS1 barcodes. GDSN is, it's someone like Syndigo or One World Sync, or now there's another one called River. There are all these different companies that basically you put your information in and they push it out to the customer. And you only need one generally, though more customers are trying to take control of that revenue stream, I think. But that's where you go populate it for retail. You say this barcode equals this product, and this is how you read the lot code. And it was really created initially to give you a view to the supply chain, right? For food safety and all the things. In food service, they use that to populate the DSR, the distributor sales reps book, but also the operator's book. And there are fields that you do for food service that you don't do for retail that most people miss because they don't, nobody tells them that. And then they don't know how to do or do it right. So those are three little projects that we do for people that can really push you along fast. Now, again, a lot of them are like, well, but I just want you to sell. I'm like, great, but I'm not selling if you don't have these things in place, because we won't be successful.
Yeah. So I guess the next question is, for an emerging brand, somebody want, they have an idea. I want to create a product. Like, where do they start? right? There's different stages, there's different consultancies. Some say they'll take them from infancy, but half the time they don't know what the hell they're doing, and from what I've seen. But then and there's others that are like, well, we need them to be established, like you said, to that point. Like we need them to be at least somewhat farther along that I can really push them, and we're not literally starting from the ground. So what do you say to that emerging brand or person that's like, I have an idea, I want to do something. Where do they start?
So again, it depends on how much money they have and what they know about food. And are they planning on retail versus food service? Do they know? Do they have a good rationale for why? Because I would get a lot of people that said, well, I want you to just do for what you did for Impossible. It looks like food service is easier. And it's like, it's not easier, but it's stickier. But you got to do it right to start.
Right.
So for me, like, and we've worked with brands that are 2 years out from getting their grass, like whatever their FDA stuff is done. And where we literally pulled apart everything they were thinking about commercialization and giving them their perspective from a sales point of view of you're planning today for a product you're not going to sell for 2 years. Today's trends don't matter. You need
right.
What are the trends that are coming? And you better find somebody who's good at calling those things or at least giving a way to think about it. So for us, I'll start with anybody anywhere from like, I have an idea all the way up to we've worked with some of the biggest food companies in the world. Because what we do is say, where are you today? What's the problem you're trying to solve? And then how can we help you think about it and or execute against it? For somebody who's just getting started. And again, I think there are a lot of people who do commercialization work and new product development work that do it in a lab and report out a product. And then there are all kinds of things that happen. And eventually they talk to somebody about sales. And if they just talk to us first, they might have produced a different product. They might have created a different forecast. They may have said maybe no to food service or like we're all in, but we got to do these things first. I think one of the things that's most frustrating for me as a salesperson and dealing with these brands who have a finite amount of time because they're small teams or they have a finite amount of money runway is that they don't actually talk to somebody who knows what it's going to be like to sell the product, any product, into the channel. Because your channel choice up front is critical to your packaging, your pricing, salespeople, like when you start and how you start. Who you're talking to. And a lot of brands that are trying to get funding, they use PR to get funding, but that PR can create whiplash for them as they start to sell. I encountered that with Impossible as well. They were a PR machine, but dear God, some of that PR was like, I don't care what you're trying to tell the investors. You're in market now, and like that won't flop.
Like, yeah, and maybe give a quick definition too of channel. You said channel quite a few times, and I don't know that some know what that actually means.
So when you sell, so you'll hear the term omni-channel, that means all channels. But effectively, if you're selling a food or beverage, or you're selling anything that's going to go to a retailer or a food service operator, right? You're going to sell either through retail, right? So it's grocery stores, mass, drug club, right? Where you're selling it to a box store who's selling it. You've got e-commerce, where you're selling it through what is technically a virtual store. You've got direct to consumer. So it is what it sounds like. You've got food service, which is any place that's creating and selling, preparing food for you to eat away from home. Although it's been blurring. Companies like HEB and Wegmans and Mariano's have amazing food service. And Hy-Vee, by the way, is the OG of food service at retail. They don't get the credit. Their salad bars were an entire aisle long.
Wow.
They would pull out chairs and tables in the store for people to eat lunch at Hy-Vee at their salad bar. It was crazy. That was one of the things I had to chase at PepsiCo for Fountain. And I was blown away by their food service offerings. And then you've got what's called industrial. So industrial is where a lot of people might call it private label. But you're selling your product as an ingredient to someone, whether it's a co-man or to another manufacturer, for them to use it in production of their product, branded or not branded. So really, when I talk about channels, I talk about retail, food service, industrial, I don't think about D2C because it's not, we don't really do that. And that's a totally different sort of way of thinking. You can go from D2C to any of the others, but where we focus, and you might start in D2C and that's fine. But as soon as you're moving into channels, and they're all B2B if it's not D2C. So they're all business to business, where you're selling to someone who's going to actually sell your product on your behalf to the consumer or end user.
Right.
And a lot of brands don't think about that, right? So again, you've got to sell to that person who's the gatekeeper to you actually getting to the person who's going to use the product. And in food service, you're selling it to somebody who's going to use the product to then sell it to the consumer. And you will never know who that consumer is like you do in retail.
Yeah.
Different podcast, because I can wax poetic about that.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're coming up on time and I want to be conscious of your time because I know you got crazy schedule. But just a couple things to wrap it up. Like what consumer, you talked about trends and not thinking about today, right? You're launching a product in 2 years, not today. But for today, what kind of consumer trends, macro trends are you thinking are just emerging? They're coming out, they're starting. And then I guess maybe a glimpse in the future, you know, what's your quick forecast? You know, we're at close to the end of the year. Everyone's got their prediction stuff. Like what's on the horizon?
Anyone who is not paying attention to all the different ways distribution and food service is being blown up. So it's more, that's a more tactical discussion. But the nature of how products get delivered to end users in food service is being disrupted in ways. I had a conversation yesterday that when you hear it at first, you're like, are you kidding me? But when you sit back, you're like, holy crap, that's a great idea. So I think the distribution world's going to be rocked. From a consumer standpoint, I believe, so GLP-1s are just going to continue more and more and more to impact how we eat, where we eat, what we eat, who we sell to. I'm watching this whole political thing with Maha with a jaded eye only because it's, I like some of the things that are coming out of it as somebody who spent time in the natural space, but that's going to upend so many companies for manufacturing. I think that's going to be good for emerging brands because I think they can move faster.
Mm-hmm.
Those incumbents are going to fight hard and you're already seeing the lobbyists like really push. So for me, that trend, I think is going to play out over the next 2 to 5 years. Because again, I think people are going to wait and see like, how much is this going to stick? You know, what are the things like Coke going to the Mexican Coke thing, right? That was easy. They already had the formula. People love right. that product here in the States. Easy peasy.
Yeah.
You need it like, oh, look what we're doing. But really, so what? You're seeing the red dyes come out of things, right? That the ripple effects in supply chain. And by the way, the number of recruiters calling me right now, desperately looking for people in supply chain for manufacturers, is off the hook. And it's because, you know, again, there's a lot of robotics coming. So I think the consumer trends in a lot of cases there's not going to be a big change. It's going to be, again, how do I do more with my dollar? Because people don't have the disposable income, but they're also not willing to give up eating well or even eating out. But the GLP one, I think, is still a dark horse because there's so many other ways that it's going to impact if you look at the history. And then a little bit, I think the next 2 years are just going to be hard to pinpoint what's going to happen because there's so many unknowns. Political environment that impact the regulatory environment. And even if there are big swings, I think everybody's also going, yeah, but it could just swing all the way back at the midterms or at the next presidential election. So how much change do you make to your formulations, to your manufacturing,
right.
et cetera? But I think the supply chain is the place to be right now. Like if you want to make hay as a young person for a career, that's where.
There you go, people.
Yeah.
Get in supply chain. It's a very underestimated section.
Yes.
I don't think a lot of people don't even realize that supply chain management is a thing. And it's
huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, one last, we're talking trends, the natural food section. I've talked to a lot of people lately and it seems like everything's trending in my talkings that it's going back to like the old school ways of like truly natural food, like just real food that's really grown. Okay. So that type of thing. Do you still see brands, the fake products still continuing? Because I'm pretty sure, like, Beyond, I think their stocks have tanked and they're like, things aren't good. Again, you see it from a different perspective.
Yeah. So I would tell you, Beyond's worst move ever was going public, because they didn't have a chance to grow without it being in public. I think that, again, I think you're going to have this delineation between people who have money to spend and people who don't. And I also think you're going to have this delineation between those of us who are of a certain age, so kind of Gen X up, thinking very differently about our food, which ironically, we grew up on shit food. But, you know, Gen Z, from what I'm seeing so far, they're willing to, like, they want to buy the experience. So I'm curious to see how that shakes up with, like, real food, because, by the way, also, if they don't learn how to cook, then they're going to be eating a lot of packaged foods. There's no labor for restaurants, and to go back to real foods means, in a lot of cases, you're cooking, you've got people in the kitchen. You know, right now, I would say the next 2 years for me are figure out who you are and where you can sell and what product you're selling. And there's lots of places to go with the product. But I think there's too many other unknowns, again, politically, economically, from a regulatory perspective, for really big movement. And I think the consumer is sort of part of that as well. I think you'll see big companies making moves that are easy and are a PR moment. I'm waiting to see better innovation out of the smaller guys. And I think the funding environment, the fact that they can't get funding because everybody's been taught get funding, like bootstrapping is, you know, for a long time was, you know, for the little people. But now they're having to bootstrap and that's hard. But that's where a lot of the innovation is going to come from. So a little bit, I'll be curious to see how that shakes out.
Awesome. I love it. I love your insight. You peeled back a lot of layers to the onions today. And I know we could easily have a part two, part three in different sectors. Exactly. We can go supply chain. We could go.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Like just management and, you know, lessons learned in that space, the corporate world. There's just so many things.
I want to talk about strategy and how strategy. Many don't know what a strategy is.
They don't. We should. We could definitely get something on schedule. I would love to talk strategy and be able to let people know, again, how this all works, what they can do to be successful. Ultimately, I feel if you're a person and you're willing to help other people, like karma, I believe in it. It's going to come back on you. If you do the right things happen to you for the right reason.
I'm not doing it for free.
Exactly. Where do people go if they want to learn more about you, Alohi, contact you, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn. That's the best place to find me. Or you can go to our website, Alohi, Alohi.us.
Perfect. Awesome. This was a fantastic conversation. Stephanie, thank you again so much.
Yeah.
And for everyone listening, be on the lookout. Part two, part three, they will be coming. I will guarantee you. So
awesome.
Thanks again. And everyone, until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side. HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.